Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out, procrastination, putting it off, kicking the can down the road. In, plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out, carpet in the bathroom. Like, why? In, knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for a limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
6:13 on this Thursday morning, and again, there are some traffic problems on the West Bank Expressway. If you are headed in from the West Bank to the East Bank, there's a bad accident at Lafayette Street that has 3 lanes closed, and I presume they're working on clearing that, so you're going to want to use the surface streets or go a different way, Terry Parkway. I know a lot of people use that, but they got that restricted to one lane and then goes to another lane that's only one lane, so that's a mess as well. Anyway, be aware of that. Brent, weather. Let me tell you about the weather. Going to be another nice day today. Oh, and thanks to everybody. Wednesday at the Square yesterday, we had a great time. Noel and I were out there listening to some music and shaking hands and kissing babies. Well, not really any of that, but we did meet some people, and it was nice. Weather today is going to be a little bit warmer than it was yesterday, but still, all in all, pretty, pretty nice compared to what it's going to be in summertime. Highs today, 81, 84 tomorrow. Good Friday. A lot of people having crawfish boils. Partly cloudy then. 84 for a high Saturday with clouds. And then Easter Sunday, 83 and cloudy. And a little bit of humidity as well. Brendan Martin joins us now, Research Director at the National Council on State Boards of Nursing. Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me what's going on with the nursing shortage in the United States.
Yeah, you know, so coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen evidence actually of a workforce recovery. So that's actually really, really good news. There's many factors that likely contribute to that. But one of the things that our analysis has really pinpointed is that there has been a rebound among more experienced older nurses who decided to re-enter the workforce. The flip side of that, one of the things that's still kind of continuing to drive, some of that shortage discussion, is that many of the structural issues that nurses have long kind of term identified as some of the drivers of their intent to leave the profession, kind of contributing to that shortfall, really remain in 2024. So we're not out of the woods yet, but we are actually seeing some kind of silver linings out of our work.
I don't think you have to be Nostradamus to know I'm going to ask you next. What are those structural problems?
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate the question. So one of the things that we've seen consistently in our survey, so we run the National Nursing Workforce Survey every 2 years or so since mm-hmm. 2013. We have seen consistently that nurses pretty uniformly report issues with short staffing, with high workloads that kind of accompany the short staffing. And then, acute levels of burnout and stress, workplace violence, and even bullying. In our survey, about 25 to 35% of nurses identified short staffing and high workloads as the reason why they departed the workforce. And really a whopping 40% of nurses, so that's 2 in 5 nurses across the entire country, indicated that acute levels of burnout and stress were really ultimately driving their intent to leave the profession.
Bullying by whom?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question.
Bullying by whom? Doctors or patients or families?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. Yeah, so, you know, it's actually, it's a multitude of issues. And so it could be kind of patient-on-provider bullying. It could be peer-to-peer bullying. It could be, you know, kind of colleague-based. And so it's actually, you know, an array of factors when we get into, you know, workplace violence and workplace bullying. The context for the care in which the nurse is, you know, working, really it's imperative that that is perceived as a safe space. And we see that that level is actually increasing. And we're not the only ones who document that in our work.
Where does the support staff factor into this with nurse burnout? Because I would think, let me take a step back. I lost both parents 20 years ago, about, you know, average, to long systemic illnesses. They were in the hospital for a long time, eventually died in the hospital. And I know even then, 20 years ago, they had one registered nurse, one RN on the entire floor, and good luck finding one. And not to criticize them, because they were busy with a whole floor, at least a whole wing, one half of a floor of patients. I presume the staffing has not gone up any from the hospital standpoint since then?
Yeah, staffing is one of the chronic issues which has really plagued, you know, really the nursing industry for decades. In our survey, we saw that issues with understaffing and high workloads obviously spiked during the emergency phase of the COVID-19 pandemic. I don't think that that comes as news to anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to 2020 and 2022, we have seen some of those issues moderate, but I think you're touching on something which is absolutely true, which is these problems long predated the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about low staffing and high workloads, this is decades of evidence that have really pinpointed these as structural issues within the nursing workforce. And so what we argue with our survey is that, you know, nurses are really collectively making their voices heard. And it's imperative that leaders across an array of sectors. So, you know, practice is obviously what we're discussing here, but also regulation, education, policy, that they all come together to try to address these issues, which nurses have been discussing for, you know, for decades. Because you hit on it, which is, you know, our focus here at NCSBN is patient safety. It's mm-hmm. taking the patient's perspective at that kind of moment in care. And so to support patients ultimately requires us to put in place policies that support nurses themselves so that they can practice to the top of their license and education and make sure that patients are well taken care of and that ultimately they're safe and they get discharged and they go home and they live, you know, great lives.
Let's talk about support staff and organizational chart, because, okay, you got the RN that I would guess is in charge of the floor, and then beyond that they have support staff, orderlies, registered nurses, what are practical nurses, I guess, in Louisiana they call
practical
them.
Practical nurses, nurse aides. Yeah.
Nurse aides. But if those people don't do their job or they don't have enough of those people, then it falls back on the RN, who is ultimately responsible. Accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate. Yeah, I think, you know, you're hitting on something. One of the things that makes, I think, our survey unique is that, you know, we run the largest and most comprehensive survey of the nursing workforce in the country every 2 years. So we not only look at registered nurses, which is where kind of the focus of our discussion has been, but we also look at practical nurses. And I think that there's movement afoot, which is really well advised, you know, to think about how we can better leverage, you know, different license types in the practice setting, in particular acute direct patient care. I think it is imperative that we rethink that and we kind of put in place policy to make sure that essentially registered nurses aren't overworked, that practical nurses aren't overworked, because many of the issues that we saw in the registered nurse workforce associated with high workloads, you know, and understaffing are also prevalent in the practical nurse workforce as well. And so we have to be cognizant of the fact that essentially, you know, every setting needs to be, you know, well-staffed, the context needs to be safe, et cetera, to ensure patient safety. And so part of that is going to be, you know, making sure that essentially, you know, the support staff that maybe underlies the registered nurse is in place, that it's robust, that they feel that they are in a position to also practice to the top of their license and education.
I'd like to open an Okunaw Jeweler Talk and Text line here, 504-260-1870. Talk, text, and data rates may apply, messaging rates, whatever it is. Please don't text and drive. But if you've had a family member in a hospital lately, I'd like to know what your experience has been. As I said, I went through it 20 years ago, and I'll tell you this, Brendan Martin, Research Director for the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, the doctor may ultimately, you know, be the macro provider of care, but for family members, if they really want to know what's going on, and the primary caregiver to that patient is the nurse in the hospital. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly correct. And, you know, in fact, you know, so nursing is both the largest healthcare workforce in the United States, but it's also the most trusted. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a reason for that. There's a kind of a compassion that comes along with the nurse's care at the bedside. And I think when well supported and the context is safe and they feel as though they have the resources that they need to, you know, perform to their peak, you know, I think what we find time and time again is that nursing care is absolutely vital, not just to patient safety, but better patient outcomes.
I think.
And so you are correct. I mean, that they're going to interface the most with the nurse, and it's really important to patient outcomes.
I've seen it firsthand in terms of compassion, and I think there's a cause and effect factor where, you know, a doctor might have 1,000 patients he sees in the office, makes his rounds in the hospital, but the nurse for those 8-12 hours, however long he or she is on that shift, they are intensely concentrated on those however many people happen to be in the beds that they are over. So God bless them all. 622, we'll pick up the conversation when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 628, just a couple of minutes left with Brendan Martin. They got a new survey out. He's a research director, Dr. Brendan Martin, of the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. I can tell you what, I was talking about my parents, Brendan, but I've had eye surgery, shoulder surgery, knee surgery, hernia surgery. Just about every part of me has been cut on. And the true compassion that you get in a hospital comes from the nurses, and God bless them and the work they do. Quickly, with the 90 seconds that we have left, when it comes from the study, was it more of a motion picture about how we got to there to here, or a snapshot? And looking forward, how do you make nursing better, attract more applicants?
Yeah, you know, I think the overall takeaway for our survey is that we've seen, you know, early momentum, as I mentioned, for a workforce recovery. But I think that the big takeaway is that we're not out of the woods yet. Mm. You know, you've shared some of your kind of personal background, both as a patient and with your parents. You know, my wife is a nurse of over 10 years, and I can personally attest to the fact that they take their job home with them. Mm. There's a reason why they are called to this profession. There's a reason why they understand and basically place such an importance on that direct patient care. And so I think it's imperative that moving forward that we think about how do we solve some of the long-term structural issues that we see come out of this survey, that nurses report very uniformly and for decades. You know, so short staffing, high workloads, burnout and stress. You know, if we don't address some of these issues moving forward, then I think, you know, we started this conversation with kind of the premise of thinking about this in kind of a shortage context. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to get there pretty quickly if we don't start to be proactive with our policy and make sure that nurses feel supported and make sure that nurses feel as though they're able to practice to the top of their license and education. Because at the end of the day, if our focus is on patient safety, the vehicle for that is making sure that nurses are well-equipped and resourced and supported to really deliver that high-quality care.
You know, as you talked about your wife, I thought, Brendan, I would think in 95% of the time it's the nurse who breaks the news to the loved one that the person has expired and not the doctor.
Yeah, you know, and I think we saw this in spades with the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, you don't need peer-reviewed literature or research to really drive that point home. We saw it, you know, at headlines day after day after day. You know, my own wife, you know, was oftentimes the last person to see a loved one in that hospital context because of all the restrictions, you know, with, you know, minimum distance requirements, et cetera. And, you know, they take that load with them. I think that they are called to this profession, nurses, that is.
I think you're right.
And so when we think about, you know, burnout and stress, that's a label, right, to a lot of us. But it's a lived reality for them. Mm-hmm. And I think to make sure that we are putting into place policy to address that, it's complicated. I don't want to make it sound simple, but it's really imperative that we do that.
Thank you. Got to run. I appreciate your time and your effort, and God bless your wife. Brendan Martin will take a break and back. Talk to Mike Strain. Time now, WWL First News. Happy Crawfish Day 2025. 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our good friend, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Dr. Strain?
Man, I am doing great. And again, happy National Crawfish Day. I am ready. We're going to be eating some crawfish tonight. I will be in Clarence, Louisiana, which is above Natchitoches, my good friend, Mr. Rayburn Smith. He's a cattleman, a cattle buyer, and he's having a big cattle sale today. He will sell between 45 and 50,000 head of cattle today in Natchitoches Parish, and it's part of Superior Livestock. And then he has a big crawfish boil, and all the farmers from around this state and multiple states will be there in Clarence on the farm. So we'll be there about 6 o'clock. With my very good friend, and he sold a lot of cattle for me personally over the years, and it's great. And look, the crawfish, you got to say, they are really, 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 really nice right now. And then tomorrow we'll be here on the farm, you know, on Good Friday here on Strain Farms. My brother will be boiling the crawfish. He won't let me boil them. He says I don't do it right. He does it better.
You don't need any of that going on. Just let him do it, Mike.
You know how I boil shrimp?
How?
I get started, and he moves me out the way. So, look, let me show you how to do it every time. We've been doing that for 40 years.
Y'all get along?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Because you move aside and let him have it. You know what? That's
absolutely
the best way to do it.
Well, that's the plan, though. Yeah. You got to understand. That's how I cook shrimp, right?
I
get everything started. And I take that great big metal spoon and get out the way. Let me show you how it's done.
Kind of like the old Tom Sawyer painting a fence thing you got going on there, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, brother gets here to the farm every day, and we work on the farm, and he's my chief mechanic, too. He is very, 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 very good at mechanicking and body work on all these old antique tractors.
You fly into Clarence, Louisiana, or you driving?
Yeah. No, I have to fly because it's just too far.
Yeah, I guess so. You better leave now if you go get there.
3.5-4-hour trip. Yeah. If you drive each way.
So what else is going on, Mike? Let's talk about crawfish and plentiful and prices and all that stuff compared to last season.
Right, it's good. I mean, you can find crawfish under $3 a pound right now. I looked this morning on the crawfish app, which everyone needs to get. You can get them live at Rouse's for $2.95. Now, if you're planning on getting crawfish for tomorrow, you need to go ahead and get them ordered so that you'll have them. And, you know, just don't wait and, you know, don't get everything set up, then just show up and say, look, I need 2 sacks of crawfish. So get them ordered right now. They're very plentiful. They're very nice. And the price is right. And you can find shrimp as well. You can find shrimp under $6 a pound. Really nice, nice shrimp. And, of course, you got to add all the fixings. Sweet potatoes, yam right, corn on the cob, mushrooms, a little sausage, you name it, put it in the pot, right? And it's time for a little fun. A little bit of family, so we're really excited about that.
How'd everything go at the Strawberry Fest? I know I had a little bit of trouble, but that's
how it
happens everywhere you go.
It was huge. So me and Jazzy rode on the float, and there were more than 100,000 people there. We've been eating strawberries ever since. So it was a really beautiful, beautiful day. The farmers were turned out, the people turned out, and people are ready to kind of relax and have fun. It's a very, you know, it's a very good, overall festival. We're having festivals all over the state. And again, local fresh strawberries. Now, you got to have that for Easter. You got to have some local strawberries and maybe some Elmer's Gold Bricks as well. And you can get the strawberry heavenly hash. That's right.
Yes,
and you
sir. You sure
good.
Can. Yeah, that was our good.
Product.
Dark chocolate what? Heavenly hash, milk chocolate heavenly hash. Put all three together in a bowl, melt them, then pour it on top of some ice cream, Mike. You got some eating going on.
Some vanilla, some bluebell vanilla ice cream.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yep. I hope my doctor's not listening, but we may have to try that, right?
I'm preaching to the choir on this one. Let me take a break. We'll come back. I want to talk about hurricane season. Will be here too long. What's going on with bugs and insects and caterpillars and all of that stuff? And also, somebody texted in, they got a dog that's digging and eating constantly. And I know you're a respected and loved, beloved veterinarian on the North Shore. Maybe you can address that as well. The dog's eating the fence, they say. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. Holy Thursday, 6:56 and a half, talking to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture. It's also National Crawfish Day. And, of course, tomorrow a lot of people get together for shrimp boils, crawfish boils. Mike, when it comes to imported seafood, you can't buy live imported crawfish, correct? If you buy live crawfish, you know it's from Louisiana?
It's going to be from Louisiana, but also under the law, if it's imported, they've got to have a sign there. It's got to be on the menu. But if it's live, they're going to be getting those from Louisiana. They're very plentiful. The only way you get into the importer, you will find frozen crawfish. Now, it is possible to buy frozen whole crawfish that are imported. I don't recommend you do so. We have some wonderful crawfish here. Also, a number of our different companies like J. Bernard and Riceland Crawfish, they put 3- and 5-pound bags of their pre-boiled. They're boiled crawfish with the seasoning in them. They're in a bag. They're frozen. You put that in hot water, boiling water, for 10 minutes. You open it up. It's like you boiled them right there on site for yourself. Mm-hmm. Average person will eat 3 pounds. It's very good and available and at many of your Rouse's and other stores.
Somebody texted in about shrimp real quick to delineate between live and uncooked. If it's live crawfish, you know it's local, but if it's shrimp that are uncooked, it could be foreign, right?
It could be, but, where are you going to find the foreign shrimp? Those that are prepackaged, and generally they're going into restaurants and other things or into your different grocery stores. If they are loose, whether you go in and you see they got a scoop and they're putting them into a container for you, those are generally going to be local. But, again, look for the sign at wherever they're selling them. If they are selling imported crawfish, imported shrimp, imported whatever, they've got to have a sign up there, so look for that. If you stop on the side of the road, if you like to do that, and buy those shrimp right there and those coolers when they're sitting on ice, those are going to be local shrimp. And, of course, don't forget crabs as well, right? You got the White Boot Warriors and others selling some of the finest crabs you ever did see. It'd be a good time for
Mike,
a crab boil as well.
Real quick, only got 40 seconds left. Somebody texted in. I know you're a beloved veterinarian on the North Shore. Dog eating the fence boards. What would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them get some cone toys and spend more time with the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Or bring the dog to train to get that dog active. I love the cone toys, especially the ones you can stuff with peanut butter, put mm-hmm. them in the freezer, let them get cold. Get them to chewing something else. Play with them, spend time with them, and get them some toys. Let them chew on those cone toys.
There's nothing that draws a dog to wood or anything, is there?
No, they just, they all go through that chewing phase, mm-hmm. right? But they're looking at, they want some attention. Get out there and spend some time with them. And, again, the more time you spend with them, the less they're going to have that type of behavior.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. Have a lovely Easter, you and all the strains, and a good Friday and everything else. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Kirk Talbot about insurance, legislative session, and more. Then we'll talk to Jason Williams, DA, on WWL. 7:13 now on this Holy Thursday, and looking ahead to the Easter weekend today. We're talking a little bit warmer than it was yesterday, and yesterday was delightful. Wednesday at the Square. Again, thanks for having Newell and I out there and everybody that turned out. Highs of 81 today, 84 tomorrow for Good Friday for those crawfish boils or religious observances you may be having. 84 on Saturday. Cloudy Sunday. Highs closer to 85 with plenty of clouds. Could be humid as well, so might be a little bit warm, but at least it'll be dry for whatever it is you happen to be doing on Easter Sunday, be it religious or otherwise. Kirk Talbot joins us now, Louisiana State Senator, Chairman of the Senate Insurance Committee. How you doing, Kirk?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Good morning.
No, you're not. You're tired, and you, Lord knows what you're dealing with, the legislator, but session. But you know what? I'm glad you lied, Kirk, because nobody cares anyway, right?
That's right.
Nobody gives a come yeah. on. How you doing? Does anybody really want to know? Absolutely not. Just say fine and keep going. All right, so I'm looking at a NOLA.com story here. Tyler Bridges, Governor Landry wins early round in Louisiana car insurance fight with Commissioner Tim Temple. Let me read the first paragraph, and keep in mind this was a House committee, and Kirk Talbot's chairman of the Senate committee. Am I right on that? This was a House committee
yeah.
yesterday? Yeah. High stakes legal political battle between Governor Jeff Landry and Insurance Commissioner Tim Temple, one that affects everyone who has car insurance, played out in a House committee room at the state capitol on yesterday. After hearing from Landry, the House Insurance Committee sided with him by overwhelmingly passing a measure that he said would allow Temple to reject excessive rate increases for car insurance. Now, the political context on this is the governor can wield political power over legislators. Tim Temple cannot. Tim Temple is an elected official, and the governor said that if if rates don't go down, then it's on him, talking to Tim about Tim Temple. He said that to a Baton Rouge talk show host. So that's the political underpinnings. Let's talk about the actual thing that the House Insurance Committee did yesterday, and is the Senate Insurance Committee likely to do the same, and that is allowing Temple to reject excessive rate increases for car insurance. What does that mean?
Well, he can do that now. He just has to use criteria like actuarially justified. In other words, if an insurance company comes to him and says, I need to raise my auto insurance rates, they have to produce evidence of why. They have to show him their incurred losses, the amount of money they're paying out to settle claims. There's an actuarial study that is part of this, and it's justified on that. And how we got here was we had a rating commission, 20 or 30 years ago, that was 7 members, 6 appointed by the governor and then the commissioner, and it was a disaster. It was corrupt. It was picked winners and losers, and the trend back then, if from what I've been told, was that a lot of states had rating commissions like that, and people started gravitating towards, let's give the commissioner, whether it's appointed or elected, the power to do it. But it's got to be based on science, on the data, on the actuarial, tables or whatever you want to call it, the sound science. And that's what we did. There's only one state that really has a rating commission left, and that's the state of California. So, the governor and Commissioner Temple and the legislature, we all want to solve the same problem, and we're all on the same page there. There's just different ways to do it, and we have different opinions on how to get there. So I appreciate very much the governor showing a lot of interest in this, and he's right. We got to get this done. I'm a little concerned that if it seems like this bill is going to, might take away some of the data behind it. And I just don't want to, and I don't know if this bill does this yet. We've got to really look at it and study it. We were kind of busy yesterday, so I didn't get to watch all the testimony. I'm going to go back and do that over the weekend. But we just want to make sure that we're doing things the right way. And, it's certainly a bill that's worth looking at.
So wait, Kirk, and we're talking about what happened in the Senate yesterday, in your committee yesterday, because you also considered two of your bills, right, Senate Insurance Committee?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, just so I can get back to understanding this HB 576, how does it stand now? Who decides what kind of insurance, car insurance increases companies get, and what would this change?
So right now, the commissioner can deny rates that are deemed excessive. So if an insurance company comes and says, and the commissioner testified to this yesterday, and former Commissioner Donilon has said this many times, they deny rates all the time. A company comes in and says, I want to raise my auto rates X amount. They have to show the justification for that, and the commissioner can deny it or approve it, and they get denied all the time.
Okay.
And it's based on, show me your expenses, show me the amount of dollars you're paying out in the form of claims. You can't just say, I want to raise, and have some excessive rate. You've got to justify it.
And what's going to change?
This bill kind of tinkers with that. It kind of takes away the data and the science behind it a little bit. So we're still trying to figure out exactly what this does. The governor had pointed to Mississippi, which has got some different criteria than we have. And they have some good criteria. Insurance in Mississippi is very affordable. Now, one of the main reasons, in my opinion, that Mississippi is affordable is they have $1 million cap on bodily injury damages. You cannot recover more than $1 million for bodily injury in the state of Mississippi. That's what's keeping their rates low. We don't have that here. And we do have a bill. Peter Egan from the North Shore has a bill to cap bodily injury at $5 million. I'm not saying that's what we should do. But that's one of the reasons why, and I don't know if it was talked about yesterday, why their rates are stable and why they're lower.
So in Tyler Bridges' story, he quotes Tim Temple as saying that House Bill 576 would give the commissioner authority to act capriciously in ruling whether to approve rate increases. So it seems to me, and look, I'm just a layman in all of this, right, Kirk? But it seems like, well, if, as it stands now, the insurance companies can actuarially come in and say, this is what we paid out in damages, this is why we need to have a rate increase, And then they're going to change it to where a commissioner can say, no, you're not going to have a rate increase. But they don't change the circumstances that led to what the insurance companies paid out. The end result is going to be there's going to be less people writing car insurance in Louisiana. Am I making that up in my head or not?
That's what the commissioner testified to yesterday. Mm-hmm. We're, you know, my staff and myself are going to be looking at this bill over the weekend to see exactly what it does and kind of go over the testimony and look at all the things that were said. So, and, you know, we're going to look at what other states do. You know, if we're an outlier in some way or other states are doing it better than us, then you know, maybe we need to take a look at that.
Now, let me take a break. We're going to pick up the Senate committee. You're the chairman of that committee. What you guys happened at your committee hearing yesterday. 7:21, talking to Senator Kirk Talbot. They're going to try to take on car insurance. I'm doubtful. I'm named Thomas. Keep that in mind. Hopefully something will change. We'll continue the conversation. We come back. Oakenheart Jeweler talking text lines open at 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments, text, data, message rates may apply. Don't text and drive. Traffic now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Kirk Talbot talking about car insurance and injury caps. Kirk, I remember having a conversation with an attorney a while back about an airline crash or something. He told me about an injury cap in Louisiana. Is there an injury a cap in Louisiana if you die in an airplane crash?
I don't know. That I don't know.
I seem to remember that it was a lot lower than $5 million, and it would just seem silly that you would have a cap on that, but you wouldn't have a cap on a reasonable cap on automobile injuries or whatever the word is, compensation, however you want to say it. Tell me what you guys heard in the Senate side yesterday.
So we only heard three bills yesterday, and normally the first week of session, we usually don't hear bills. We usually hear, you know, testimony from the different departments and things like that. So we really hit the ground running this session. It is a shorter session, a 60-day rather than an 85-day non-fiscal session, so we kind of wanted to hit the ground running. But one of the bills I did was Senate Bill 136 that just deals with rate transparency. If you're getting renewed from your property insurance or from your auto insurance, they're going to break down, you know, this is why your rate is the way it is. This is your risk factor. These are the factors that played into the rate that you have. So I think that's important. I think it's a bill I did on the behest of the commissioner. It's a department bill. So I think that's good. You know, I think it's something I certainly want to see. I want to see what are the factors that led to my rate, whether it's homeowners or auto insurance. So I think that's a good bill, and it passed out unopposed, and I don't see it getting any opposition. I think it'll fly through.
When it comes to home insurance and fortified roof, I know I was talking to a garage guy not too long ago, and he talked about if you don't have a fortified garage, winds of 120 miles an hour can take the roof right off the house, and somebody had told me that right after Katrina, so it reinforced that. Is that anything the legislature will look at, or is it more about the low-hanging fruit of the fortified roofs and preventing the water damage, even if it's a Category 1?
Well, I guess if your garage is part of your house, then the garage
obviously
is
an attached garage.
Yeah, under that roof, yeah. But, I mean, the grant program is for your house, not for detached buildings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Fortified Roof Program is doing extremely well. We just had a state auditor release a report showing that the average savings is 22% on your premium. So I strongly urge people to apply for that. I've got a bill, Tommy, that instead of waiting for the lottery or hoping to be picked in that lottery, we'll just go ahead and we'll give you a $10,000 tax credit, which is $10,000 is the amount of the lottery grant. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and put the roof on and just take a $10,000 tax credit. If you can front the money on the front end, go ahead and do it. And let's get as many fortified roofs on as humanly possible.
It would seem like if it's the way to legitimately lower rates and the word lottery is involved, you're not really chopping the right amount of wood. Thank you, Kirk. I appreciate your time. We'll talk to you again. Louisiana State Senator Kirk Talbot, also chairman of the Senate Insurance Commission. We'll take a break, come back, talk to District Attorney Jason Williams. Right now, time for WWL First News. Moving right along, 7:45, quarter till 8, District Attorney Jason Williams joins us right now. How you doing, J.A.?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
Those initials didn't sound right, but you understand what I'm saying, Jason Williams. How's everybody?
Good? I'm sorry. Everybody's real good. My youngest son calls me Jay half the time, too.
Okay,
so
all right.
I'm used to it.
The A part, I guess. I don't know where I got J-A from. J-W. What am I talking about, J-A? I guess I'm thinking of D-A. I combined all of that. Moving too fast. Let's talk about the French Quarter Festival violence. Man, you talk about if ever there was an indication of if somebody's hell-bent on doing something, even the Secret Service, you can have whoever you want there, as much of a law enforcement president as you want, and they're going to do it.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right, Tommy. I was listening to Ronnie Surpass the other day on your station, and he was absolutely right in what he was saying. And it really goes back to the conversation we had about a year ago. You know, we don't need guns.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Midi Health. At any given time, 61% of adult women say they want to lose weight. But for many, that's easier said than done. If you've had trouble losing weight, don't lose hope. Midi Health uses a deep understanding of women's hormones and a combination of weight loss medications to create a customized plan for each user. Midi Health can help you achieve more effective and sustainable weight loss by addressing hormone imbalances. Midi can also prescribe proven weight loss medications that help you experience reduced appetite and increased feelings of fullness. When paired with hormone optimization, you're not just managing your weight, you're also supporting your body's natural processes, which means you can overcome those weight loss plateaus that in the past have been so difficult to move beyond. So if you're ready to combine the power of hormones with the power of weight loss medications, visit joinmidi.com today. Discover how this innovative approach can lead you to lasting success. That's joinmidi.com.
At MLBShop.com, you can get all the latest officially licensed merchandise for you and your family. But if you really want to level up your game, you can grab something for your dog walker, your Pilates instructor, your swim coach, your neighbor, your accountant, your gardener, your best friend, your bandmate, your boss, your kid's teacher, your mailman. Visit MLBShop.com and stock up on officially licensed on-field merchandise from your favorite teams.
Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
In the French Quarter, unless they're in the holsters of the state police and the NOPD. Whether this individual was responding to shots fired or whether he was the first person shooting indiscriminately in a crowd of people never works well. And that's a prime example of it.
And if you're listening yesterday with my conversation with Ronnie, you also heard me ask about what does that say about the security plan for the quarter as presented by Tenio, because that wouldn't address any of that because state law doesn't prohibit any of that, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you can plan around most things, but you can't plan for everything. I think the report's a solid report, but as they said, and as you've heard Councilmember Freddie King, my good friend, say, things have to be tailored to a place and tailored to the city. And at the end of the day, we talk about what is the best solution to prevent crimes like that. It's fewer guns in the hands of people who do not understand how to use them and don't care about human life.
Hey, well, you got like Freddie King. He's a Shaw graduate.
I knew that. That's why I picked him rather than Ann Kirkpatrick. They both said the same thing, but I was appealing to your base interest.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, Jason. That's you can never go wrong doing that. Let's talk about ankle monitoring and a real time, because this is a serious thing, real-time juvenile ankle monitoring, because we've had one heck of a problem with that.
It is a huge problem. It's still a huge problem. Council Member Moreno did help and worked with her fellow council members to allocate $2 million that would go to real-time monitoring with individuals who are trained with dealing with juveniles. That is absolutely a step in the right direction. These folks will be responsible for picking up an individual who has deemed to be non-compliant and have violated. However, the other missing component to that is having judges call that in. The judge that decides sometimes over our objection to send a person back out into community when we're asking them to stay housed in jail and they want to put them on an ankle monitor, when they receive that report of non-compliance, they've got to put that warrant out and they've got to let these folks know it's time to go pick that individual up. If they don't do that part, then the $2 million is wasted. So there still is that human element of responding very quickly to noncompliance. I wish this was in the hands of prosecutors because there's certain people I believe should not be trusted with an ankle monitor. If you've shot at someone, if you've hurt someone, if you've repeatedly broken into a car or a house, you don't deserve an ankle monitor.
So who's going to be... I'm trying to figure out what's going to change, Jason. I'm trying to keep up here, but what's going to change?
Well, so the Council President Moreno and her colleagues have pushed for and gotten $2 million to go to the state so that there are individuals who can respond. We didn't have that before, mm-hmm. other than the police department, but they've got to get a warrant first, and they weren't getting the warrants because the judges weren't calling those in and requesting them. To go pick up these juveniles if they're out after hours or outside the geolocation they're supposed to be in. But still, there's a missing component of the judge that has placed this individual on an ankle monitor, sometimes over objection. They've got to say, pull him in, bring him off the streets. And in a lot of instances, that simply just is not happening.
So it is going to happen now or not?
It depends on the court. The judges that are paying attention, the judges that are responding to noncompliance, they're asking for these individuals to be picked up for noncompliance. Some judges give second and third chances in that instance.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I'm going to give you a case study here because, you know, we all know Dennis, Matt Dennis over at ASAP and how they notify the judge if somebody tamples with the anchor monitor or leaves their confinement. So they notify the judge. This $2 million is going to provide for more people to go pick up the person, the violator. Is that right? But the short circuit the short circuit they were worried about is if the judge says, go pick him up. That's where we are?
Right. That's got to happen.
That is going to happen?
That needs to happen, but that's not always the case. You stated the case very well.
We'll pick it up when we come back with Jason Williams, District Attorney, 751, 9 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. We have a little contest here about the line of the week, and we had a leader in the clubhouse, but Jason Williams just took the lead by saying he quoted Freddie King and not Ann Kirkpatrick when I mentioned Freddie King was a Shaw graduate because you wanted to do appeal to what, Jason?
Appeal to your base.
Appeal to
your basic instinct.
I like
to always love your alma mater.
Tim Zimmer.
That's a big deal.
Got bad news for you, buddy. You've been knocked to second place by Jason Williams, taking me down on that one. So many times, Jason, I get a lot of feedback from people that's positive, and I appreciate it because I listen when I talk to people, and I'm looking at the headline here, Missy Wilkinson's story, and I'm not criticizing her at all. NOLA.com, real-time juvenile ankle monitoring program ready to launch, and then I'll talk to y'all. And then I feel like Fred Sanford, where it's like, wait, hang on here a minute, Lamont, wait, what? Because you tell me everything's going fine with the money and putting on people to go capture the people at UP, juvenile offenders that take off the monitor or tamper with it. But the chain, to use the cliche, is only as strong as its weakest link. And if the judge says, well, don't worry about it, well, then the whole thing falls apart, right?
That is absolutely right, Tommy. I mean, I think it's very dangerous, whether it's the media or whether it's a leader of an organization, to wave any victory flags in the public safety space. It takes
to be clear, I just want to jump in. Missy Wilkinson was not doing that. She probably didn't even write the headline. But I'm just saying it seemed like it sounds good, but until you delve down, it's really not, right?
It's not the whole picture.
Okay.
Even parents who love their children have to drop the hammer sometimes. If a judge says, I'm going to put you, young Tommy Tucker, on an ankle monitor, you can't go back to the quarter. You can't be out after dark. And young Tommy Tucker is in the French Quarter every single night violating the ankle monitor. And when the judge finds out, she just says, all right, look, don't do it again. And then he's there again. And he says, don't do it. At some point, you're creating bad habits. You're showing this young person there are no real consequences. The judge didn't mean what they said. And then, therefore, the ankle monitor means nothing.
Jason, let me just jump in. One minute here, real quick, before we run out of time. I see Judge Candace Vaughn Bates Anderson quoted at City Council, you're able to put him back in the community, keep him in school, keep him involved. Matt Dennis tells you the same thing. He's not against ankle monitoring. He says you can't put everybody in jail. Sometimes kids just screw up. They got to get back to school and everything else. But there are judges that have been frequent offenders when it comes to not notifying authorities when the people fool with the ankle monitors, right? Juvenile judges?
Correct. Yeah, yes, sir. And look, there are kids that benefit from ankle monitors. There are adults who benefit from them. That's great, but let's focus on the ones that don't, because those are the ones who are hurting people and killing people.
So what? How can we put attention on the juvenile judges that don't pay attention to this?
You know, I think we need automatic revocations of an ankle monitor. A single you charge with a violent crime, a judge lets you out on an ankle monitor. One violation, you're back in jail.
That'd be a state
regardless
law?
Of that. State law, municipal ordinance, agreement with the court. I think it's common sense.
Thank you. A12, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Beautiful spring day ahead, and really looking ahead to the Easter weekend. All in all, pretty nice. We have highs today of about 81 degrees, 84 tomorrow for Good Friday. A lot of outdoor activities going on. Saturday, 84 for a high, then Sunday, 83. With some clouds and humid, but, and again, you heard Peyton talk about the Crescent City Classic. It'll be kind of warm and humid with highs of 84, but thankfully no rain for any type of events. A lot of them going on this weekend. So we're talking to Dane Cialino the other day about the Chevron settlement and how now the state is in a way going after oil and gas or doesn't seem as concerned about future exploration. At least that's the way I interpreted it. And we've talked to Eric Smith before about the easy oil and gas have been gotten from the Gulf. Fracking is now the new thing, or on-land oil and gas production. And then when you look at tariffs, we thought we'd talk about the future of oil and gas in Louisiana with our friend Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Oh, doing great. Beautiful morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about the Chevron settlement. Does that, and I know, well, you're an economist. You're not a political scientist, but in any way, can you infer that means the halcyon days of easy oil and gas or big oil and gas in Louisiana, or at least offshore, are gone, and now the state's figuring and municipalities are figuring, well, that's not coming back, so we may as well go after them and try to get them to pay for the damage they caused?
Yeah, so I don't want to necessarily comment on what I think were folks' motivations or kind of what the impact of that specifically will be on the future, but I can kind of comment on certainly the trends that have happened and kind of what we're projecting moving forward.
Okay.
So oil production in Louisiana really has declined very, very significantly since the 1970s and then the kind of other little peak in the early 1980s before the price crash. And it's declined by, I can't remember the numbers, but very, very large percentages. Natural gas production in the state has actually increased over that same time period. It was flat for a while and then really increased with the Haynesville shale. This last year with no low natural gas prices, the Haynesville has dipped a little bit, but is kind of projected to continue into the future. Keep in mind, though, that is for the state, which includes, of course, the state itself, as well as 3 miles offshore. Really where a lot of the oil production and the growth in that has come from federal waters, which is not counted in the state's production numbers. And oil production in federal waters has actually really done really well over the last decade. And so I think where Louisiana is a little bit different in terms of our exposure to that upstream oil and gas sector is really in that offshore space, way much more so than, for instance, our neighbor Texas, which still has a lot of kind of production in these shale geological formations and is experiencing that kind of boom bust with the cycle. Louisiana is a little bit less so because of kind of those longer term investments in offshore. And again, that's actually done really well over the last decade or so.
So when it comes to shale, is that always land? On land, yes, or not really?
There is shale offshore. That's a type of geological formation. But when we talk about the shale boom, which is really horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, that is really the boom in that has been onshore. And the Louisiana example of that is, of course, the Haynesville, but you've got other shale plays across the country.
So when onshore. So let's talk about the difference between federal waters and Louisiana waters, and the prevalence, is it a supply or demand thing about, you know, obviously you want to get the low-hanging fruit, I call it the cheap, easy oil, maybe that's not appropriate, but when it comes to Louisiana waters, has the low-hanging fruit slash easy oil been depleted? That's all finished or what?
Yeah, so you think about a basin or a large reservoir of oil, and first you're going to have, of course, the low-hanging fruit that you get and you extract that. But at the same time, you have technological advancement that occurs over time. And these two things move in the opposite direction. You get better technology over time, even though you've produced the most productive areas over time. And so what you typically see is this kind of long-term decline curve as you produce an area, as it becomes mature. But then very specific areas due to technological advancements will become economic, and then you'll see a really large increase. And that's exactly what we saw in the Haynesville shale. And I actually think we'll see that again in oil one day in Louisiana. One example is the TMS, or the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale, which goes through the central part of the state and up towards the kind of northern toe of the boot, if you will, through the Felicianas, St. Helena parishes like that. And I believe one day we actually will see those an uptick in those, but kind of forecasting the time that'll happen is really, really difficult.
So when you look at, and I remember what it was like on the West Bank in the 80s when the oil boom was just rolling and money was all over the place, steakhouses, you name it, is like the show Dallas almost on the West Bank. If that same thing, if the same conditions were to exist today, how would the changes in technology affect employment, et cetera? I'm trying to compare apples to apples here because we talk about drill, baby, drill. We're talking about tariffs. We will in a minute, specifically as it relates to this and returning manufacturing to the United States. But when it comes to oil production in Louisiana waters, I guess what I'm trying to get a handle on, those days of the 80s, those are never coming back, or is that accurate?
You know, that really is accurate. When you look at the number of jobs that is needed to produce the same number of barrel oil today versus in the 1990s and the 1980s, you go back, it has really declined. And the reason for that is technological advancement, right? We're just so much more sophisticated today than we were 30, 40 years ago, and therefore we're more efficient and we're able to produce more with less. And so while, of course, for the employees themselves, you might think, oh, my gosh, we have less jobs. But in terms of long-term technological growth and economic growth, that's what drives economic growth in the long run, is being more efficient and advancements in technology.
And I'm not making any political point here. I'm not trying to prove anybody wrong. I'm just trying to look at what's real And what's real is for people that are that remember the days on the West Bank and so forth of big oil and when it was just rolling and flowing and money was everywhere, to be clear, that's never going to happen again.
Yeah, in terms of the jobs, you won't need as many jobs, but you take the, again, the example of the Haynesville Shale up in northwest Louisiana. I mean, that was an enormous boom to that area. You had landowners that got, you know, enormous royalty payments. An enormous amount of tax revenues went to those parishes. I mean, really transformed their school systems and their roads. So certainly there's a lot of benefits of that economic activity occurring in a place. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just the sheer number of man hours and people you need, that's never going to be back to where it was in the 80s.
Time changed. As a matter of fact, I rode the elevator just now with somebody that said they were back in the day. I think they were in California in a place where they actually still had an elevator attendant. And it's similar to that almost where you can watch old movies and see a lot of jobs that are there that due to technological advancements are not there anymore, right?
That's exactly right.
Let me take a break. We'll talk about tariffs when we come back. As I always make the example, nothing just happens, whether it's setting up chairs for a parent-teacher meeting or what have you.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Yeah, along those lines, when it comes to tariffs and infrastructure and capital spending and surety and certainty, do we even know what effect tariffs, if they're going to go on or not, are going to have on oil or gas exploration in Louisiana? Greg Upton's our guest, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. 821 traffic now, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, talking about the past and present of oil exploration in Louisiana and the Chevron settlement. And let's talk about the tariffs that I don't know what has been proposed, what's been acted on. I don't know if there have been tariffs. I know the president says drill, baby, drill, but I don't know if tariffs have been placed on any oil and gas. Where does all that stand? Greg, do you know?
Yeah, so it's kind of a fluid situation right now with kind of what tariffs will be implemented on what countries. As you and I talked about 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, there was the list of countries that President Trump had put out with the different tariffs that he was implementing on those. Those have at this point been scaled back for this 90-day period that I guess will be kind of a negotiating period. But really what everyone's doing right now is kind of watching and seeing, because it's hard to kind of, to respond to a specific policy action or what the future is going to be until you know kind of what, you know, what specifically that policy is going to be.
So has it affected the operations of, I don't know, imports, exports? I just don't understand. It seems to me, here's what I'm trying to say in my own layman's way, because I'm no Greg Upton, certainly. But it seems like we got a lot of money here that happens with a lot of investment, a lot of pre-planning, a lot of strategizing and everything else. And it seems like with this amount of uncertainty, that would throw a major monkey wrench in everything. Yes or not?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So, you know, what's the kind of motivation of a tariff? You can think about these products that are used in the U.S. and you want those products to be produced here. So a good example of that is a vehicle. Right. You've got this global supply chain and, you know, the production of those has moved elsewhere over time. And so you want to incentivize those to come back. But you also have products that we export globally. And in Louisiana, we're a net exporter to the globe, and especially in these petrochemical sectors. Mm-hmm. And so those sectors are actually negatively impacted by tariffs. And then you think about the capital investment itself. And, you know, this is in the petrochemical sector. We've identified about $115 billion worth of announcements in these export-oriented investments. But you also had the last few weeks the Hyundai steel announcement. You had the Meta Data Center announcement. These are really large investments that are coming to the state, but ultimately you're going to have to import components and parts from all over the world. And so kind of the net effect on all those, you know, for Louisiana is certainly difficult. I point to an interesting study that came out in 2018, and you might recall during the first Trump administration, and they had all the steel and aluminum tariffs. And this analysis was conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. And they actually ranked all the states in the country in terms of their vulnerability to these trade, to these tariffs and this trade war. And I'm going to read you the, in the conclusion, they actually point out Louisiana. They say, for instance, states in which production is concentrated in capital-intensive industries or export commodities can be easily purchased elsewhere. Refining in Louisiana, for instance, are likely to experience larger declines. And so this analysis estimated Louisiana could experience actually as much as an 8% reduction in our GDP in response to those tariffs for those reasons. So, yeah, we're kind of a very vulnerable part of the country because of our industries to these tariff policies.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate the time and the insight. Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. J.P. Parnell's coming up next. I got to ask him about this garbage contract and more when we return. 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:44, 16 till 9, joined by the always expressive John Paul Morrell. How you doing, J.P.?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. So would you, I'm just curious, what did Morrells do for Easter Sunday and Good Friday? Y'all got a big family crawfish boil or anything or what?
Well, considering I'm allergic to shellfish, no crawfish boil unless you're trying to kill me. So
we just
do what everyone else does. We eat fish on Friday and we'll walk in the Crescent City Classic on Saturday and then church on Sunday.
Do y'all all get together as a big family and have ham, sweet potatoes, all that stuff?
Yeah, not really.
Barbecue?
Everybody kind of... When you get married, you kind of disperse to your in-laws.
That happens, and you have kids, and then it all falls apart. So you youngsters enjoy it while you can. Let me just quickly address this IV waste thing. And I was kidding around about, you know, Kramer before on Seinfeld saying, everything's working fine, but you had to screw it up, Jerry. It seems like everything's going well with IV waste and cleaning the quarter and everything. Can't we just leave well enough alone with that or what?
It's really bizarre, Tommy. So as you know, we're in the middle of a pretty public lawsuit with Mr. Henry over the validity of his contract, and that currently is before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. One would think, logically, Sidney Torres's company has the contract for a year. You would let the court cases play out, and if they play out in Mr. Henry's favor, he gets the contract. If they don't play out in his favor, he has no contract. And it just seems very bizarre and kind of telling that rather than keep Mr. Torres in place, doing a great job till the legal case is resolved, they're trying to prematurely end Mr. Torres's contract to try and get Mr. Henry the contract before the courts weigh in on it. And, I mean, there's no real reason to do that.
That's the point.
Unless you think we're going to win the case.
The point is, if Sidney Torres was screwing it up, or there was a problem that was occurring right now that needed to be corrected, and now we're getting the statistics and type 1 and type 2 errors, that would be something different. But everything's going fine with the way the quarter's being cleaned up, at least according to your council member at large, and Freddie King will tell you the same, right? Everything's good?
Right. I mean, the businesses and residents are happy. If anything, Mr. Torres's cleaning of the quarter shows the original contract was flawed, because in the original contract, the quarter was only getting trash pickup twice a week, and it was getting the streets cleaned 3 days a week. Mr. Torres, under the emergency contract, is doing 7 days a week street cleaning. So part of what we said, even after the lawsuit started, is, hey, guys, if we look at the service that IV Waste is providing, we really need to rebid this contract based upon the expectation people have of the service level they're getting. Because once you scale back to give this busted contract to Mr. Henry, he's going to follow the contract. That's the most profitable version for him, which will be less services for the people who work, live, and deal with the quarter.
All right, let's talk about this Gambit headline I'm looking at here that just, You know, and it's a story, I don't think it's sensational at all. It's from John Stanton Gambit, editor to New Orleans officials can sexually harass workers so long as productivity doesn't decline. That seems, you know, I'm laughing at it. It's not funny if you're the one that's being sexually harassed, but it is so ridiculous on the face of it. Talk about that, JP, if you will, please.
Well, so last year, in May of last year, the city council, in a unanimous decision, fired the clerk of council because we found substantiated allegations of her sexually harassing people through unwanted touching and other kind of hostile workplace stuff over 11 years. We fired her last May. The Civil Service Commission has a six-month period to evaluate this. 1 year later, they came back and said, you know what? All that crying testimony of victims being harassed, we think that was all true. But since you didn't prove that the office suffered from it, you have to reinstate her with back pay. Now, I want to tell you two things. One of the employees in the clerk's office quit over it. So I don't know how that doesn't meet the criteria of impacting operations. But more importantly, the commission went a step further, Tommy. They published the names of all the accusers in the decision, which no one does. Mm-hmm. Because obviously you've exposed all of these women to repercussions from the clerk and her allies, because all these investigations were meant to be done in a confidential way. So, I mean, the Civil Service Commission, they not only got it wrong, they got it wrong in the most offensive way possible. And we're already in the process, Tommy, of appealing this, asking for a rehearing, which whatever that means, and then going to the courts, because between this, between the sexual harassment that happened at the homelessness office, between what happened at DPW, where you literally had an individual on tape, a supervisor call one of the employees a fat B word. Mm-hmm. Why would anyone work in this city, in City Hall, when we have an administration in a civil service that basically encourages people to not report sexual harassment, discourages them to do it, and on top of that, protects the people who are being shown obviously to have committed it? It's mind-blowing, it's disappointing, and the council is going to fight this all the way to Supreme Court if we have to, because those individuals who came forward, they don't deserve to be told, yeah, we believe you were sexually harassed, but your boss is coming back and she can keep doing it as long as productivity doesn't fall off.
I don't mean to correct anything you said, but you left out the sex room at the Carrollton Water Treatment Plant. Let's take a break, pick it up here, we come back, 8:50, 10 till 9, J.P. Morrell, our guest, Traffic Now, WWL. Got to wonder what's going on at City Hall and city government. J.P. Morrell listed some things. He left out the sex room at the Carrollton Water Plant. A Civil Service Commission finds a woman is guilty of sexual harassment and other types of harassment over an 11-year period. Not an isolated incident, but says, you know what? It didn't really affect the job performance, so you got to reinstate her. Oh, and give her back pay. Tell me about the whole setup of city government, city charter, because a lot of people know of city civil service. They might not know exactly how it works and who they're over and who comprises the Civil Service Commission, JP?
So the civil, I mean, that's a lot to do in 4 minutes.
Well, you can do it. You can get it done.
Okay, civil service is basically the establishment of workplace protections to protect people from political interference in their jobs. So it's meant to be, I can't fire you or demote you or pass you over for a promotion because you don't play politics with elected officials or people above and below you. The protection there is supposed to be tied directly to the fact that someone's trying to terminate you or not promote you or demote you for some political or non-logical reason. What you've kind of seen over the years, Tommy, is it's turned into like the board that makes it impossibly difficult to fire people because the board doesn't like people getting fired, kind of basically. I mean, it's the same board that a couple of years back, you may recall, there was that off-duty police officer who sped across the causeway drunk. Mm-hmm. The police chief fired him, and they reinstated him with back pay because they said the drunkenness and speeding happened off-duty. So it's like it's a problem. The appointment process is very hard to explain in a few minutes. It's a five-person board. One person is elected essentially by the civil service employees. The others are picked for their levels of expertise, including college presidents and the like. But there's a disconnect there. I mean, there's been a disconnect for years, and I think what we're seeing right now with the situation with the council, with our clerk, I mean, we voted 7-0. And, I mean, you know, Tommy, we don't agree on anything.
No,
we all agree this was a problem, this person needed to go. And rather than try to look – I mean, Tommy, here's the takeaway that really is heartbreaking. The four people that came forward to report this behavior, they're civil service employees too.
Mm-hmm.
So you took four civil service employees, the people who this board's supposed to protect, and said, you know what? Yeah, you guys were sexually harassed. Wasn't that bad. You guys might have been crying in your testimony. You might have been scared to come forward. The office may be operating better, which it is, without this person looming over them. But hold our beer. She has to come back. You got to pay her back pay. And, you know, things have to be the way they are because we're looking out for the supervisor who's the harasser and not the employees.
What happens next?
Well, the process was we're going to ask the board for rehearing. I don't have any faith that's going to go anywhere, but we're going to go to the Fourth Circuit Supreme Court over it because I don't know how you have a finding that sexual harassment took place and then just set it aside to go to the next step so you can get the person back in there. I mean, if you read the ruling, which you probably won't, but I'll fast forward to the end, it's obvious from reading the ruling, Tommy, that they had already decided what they were going to do and just backfilled it with just enough facts to get their point across because their material facts we brought up in the hearing that they left out because it undercut their position.
Thank you, JP. Appreciate your time. We'll talk about China and cyber attacks when we come back. It is 9:09. Congratulations to Kristen Jones of Marrero and Chris Miller, not our Chris Miller, of Metairie. They're going to Jazz Fest just for listening to WWL. And you can, too, because in a couple of minutes, I'm going to announce the code word of the day. Then you go to WWL.com/contest and you register to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest. It's that easy. And that's all. Happy festing for Miller Lite. Tastes like Miller time in WWL. So that's coming up. But first, we're joined by Gary Korn, Director of Technology Law and Security Program and an Adjunct Professor of Cyber and National Security Law and the Law of Armed Conflict at American University. He spent 26 years on active duty in the U.S. Army as a military attorney practicing national security law at the highest levels within the Department of Defense. His final 5 years, he served as the Staff Judge Advocate General Counsel to U.S. Cyber Command. So he has certainly been there and done that. And I don't know if I should call you, what was your rank in the officer, Gary?
I retired as a colonel.
As a colonel. I'll call you colonel if that's all right, is it?
That's fine.
All right, Colonel, let's talk about, first of all, as an overview to this, I don't know how you sleep at night. You got to know things that we don't know. You have to know things that are going on that we'll never know. As it relates to cyber attacks, other countries attempting to hit the United States that have to keep you awake at night, yes?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true, and there are some things that, unfortunately, I cannot share with
you.
No,
I understand that. I get that fully.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just saying, in preparation for and looking at your experience and knowing I was going to talk to you, I was just thinking about it that I don't know how you sleep at night, knowing what you know.
Well, I mean, it's some days I'm more tired than others, so that's a practical reality.
Yeah.
But you know,
get you to the gym, huh?
Yeah, get you to the gym.
Yeah.
It is. I think it's important for your audience to know. And this isn't hard to kind of track down. And but we are constantly engaged every day with adversarial threats in the cyber domain. You know, there's whether it's Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, non-state actors, criminal actors. It's just coming constantly every day. And it's been getting worse over time. And, you know, now we see actions that are directed against critical infrastructure in the U.S. You know, fortunately, to this point, nobody has actually sought to disrupt critical infrastructure, but they're positioning to be able to do so. And there's, you know, below that, there's certainly the constant theft of our intellectual property, of, you know, national secrets, et cetera, that's happening all the time. And we have to be engaged to counter and disrupt this stuff.
We're talking to Colonel Gary Cohn, Gary Korn, about cybersecurity and so forth, about something that China alleged. But I just want to look at it, an overview first, before we specifically get to that. One thing, Colonel, and you were in 26 years active U.S. Army, the thing that frightens me most about this is, unlike tanks and bombs and even drones and missiles, this doesn't really cost a lot to be terribly effective at cyber attacks, does it? Relatively speaking, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that anybody with access to the internet can present a threat. Mm-hmm. And the technology is very democratized. I mean, to really have significant impact, I do think that you have to be a fairly sophisticated actor or be pretty, you know, more lucky. And so China has a lot of resources that they put against this. Russia has a lot of resources that they put against this. And, you know, actors of that vein. So, yeah, I mean, it's a broad-based threat. There's certainly a broad, we would say, attack surface, as we are so digitally dependent and interconnected. So we have to be vigilant all the time. But, you know, there's certainly actors that have more capability to do harm than others.
Is it a function of equipment or just pure manpower and enough people to press enough keys? kind of like the old thing with a monkey and a typewriter.
You know, it's a combination of those things. You have to have the infrastructure to utilize. You have to have, you know, it's a technological environment. You have to have the technology. But ultimately, and as we say, in trying to build out our ability for cybersecurity, it is the people, right? And mm-hmm. So you have to have talent. And you know, there are some places that have a lot of access to talent and human capacity. So, you know, it's a function of all those things, but definitely it has to do with people at keyboards.
Are there nations ahead of others when it comes to training and recruiting talent at keyboards, as you say?
Well, I mean, you can look at, you know, statements not too long ago from the former director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, that said, you know, even if he could array all of his cyber expertise and operators at the FBI against the problem set, China, you know, brings more than 10 times that capacity. Or, you know, I'm paraphrasing here.
No,
but
I understand.
China has a very deep well of human capacity that they utilize in this space. So, yeah, I mean, there are some actors. You know, Russia, not as much, but they're very sophisticated in what they do, or their capability set, their talents. They're a little bit more brute force a lot of times in the operations they conduct, but you know, there's differences in approach.
Is the next the big war, that next big conflict, and as a terribly generalized statement, Colonel, I realize, but are you more concerned that that's going to be in cyberspace than it is on the battlefield? That's where we're headed?
You know, I think cyber will certainly play a role. You know, there's lots of looking back at what happened in 2022 when Russia escalated its efforts against Ukraine and invaded at a mass level. And there were efforts to use cyber in support of that. Some of those were successful, but they weren't as catastrophic as some had predicted. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, war is war. The nature of war is a constant, and it will still involve a lot of physical force. But cyber will play a role. That is exactly why China, through what's been dubbed the Volt Typhoon operations, as I was alluding to earlier, has sought to embed itself in our critical infrastructure. You can envision lots of scenarios where, if, you know, God forbid, we got into conflict with China, they could disrupt our ability to deploy forces forward. They could bring down, you know, portions of the energy grid and create chaos here domestically, et cetera. And those things will be integrated into any war in the future.
Who is it in the United States that's responsible for that? Is that shared with national security, DOD? And do we have, in your opinion, is enough money, are enough resources being dedicated to protecting the United States from such a cyber attack?
Well, it is, you know, national cybersecurity is a shared mission space. There are assets at the critical infrastructure and security agency there, and within DHS, there are assets in DOJ and the FBI that have their portions of the mission space. The National Security Agency plays its role from a signals intelligence perspective. And DOD has the U.S. Cyber Command, where I served for 5 years, that is built to defend the nation in cyberspace, focusing externally at our adversaries. So it is a team effort. We have been getting better and better over time and building out those teams and integrating and coordinating them. But I think that we are not properly resourced overall to meet the mission requirements.
Not adequately funded, and it starts with funding and goes from there?
Yeah, I mean, everything, you can't build out force structure. You can't acquire the kinds of technological infrastructure you need, et cetera, without funding. It all starts with the funding to drive resource development and capacity. So, but, you know, that's for policymakers above my grade level to ultimately decide.
But you do it. They are advised by people like you. And I'm just wondering, do the people in Congress, as far as you know, generally speaking, get the importance of this?
It's interesting. I think this is one area, fortunately, over time where we've had a fair amount of bipartisan agreement. Okay. I think they do. And Congress has done a lot in the last, decade or so to provide, both from an authorities perspective, a legal architecture, et cetera, and resourcing, more support to the executive branch's mission requirements. But, whether that's right size, again, that takes a deep analysis. And I think that, we don't have the full capacity we need to fully address this security problem set.
And will you know, or do you know, until it's too late? Because you might think you're ready, but then you're not, right?
Well, I mean, yes, that's unfortunately often the case. Mm-hmm. It takes a crisis to really galvanize energy and efforts and drive, broader changes. We saw that after September 11th, for example. You just, hope is not a method, but you have to hope that, we have enough to stave off a real crisis, but that if a crisis comes, we have the resiliency and the depth and the ability to react quickly enough to mitigate the crisis.
You know, I guess what I'm thinking, in conventional warfare, there are so many scenarios, like whether you want to look at the movies from the 1940s with the tabletop exercises or, the computer-plotted scenarios. I just wonder, when it comes to cybersecurity, can you really anticipate everything, and I guess that's a self-answering question. You can't, but because you don't really know what the other side is up to, right, or what they have, or how do you even go about anticipating what is possible when you don't know what's possible?
Well, I mean, that's as you know, that's true of, I think, any threat scenario in any domain. You say in the military, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And it's not the plan that matters. It's the fact that you've gone through the planning to position yourself as best you can and to have the flexibility to move off that plan. There's an aspect of what we do know. There's the need for deep intelligence. This is something that my former commander, boss, client, General Nakasone, was very focused on. And it's this notion of what was termed persistent engagement in cyberspace, so that at all levels, starting with the intelligence, we have a better sight picture of what our adversaries' capabilities are, what their intentions and plans are, and how they're maneuvering against us. But it is a very dynamic space, and we are in contact with our adversaries every day. So it's an evolving problem set.
Let me grab a break. I'm sorry, Colonel, finish your thought, please.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
No, like I said, we're going to grab a break here, and then we'll come back and talk about China. And somebody texted in, we always hear about others trying to hack us. Are we doing the same to them? We'll talk about an accusation from China when we come back. We're talking with Colonel Gary Korn, Director of the Technology Law and Security Program, an adjunct professor of cyber and national security law and the law of armed conflict at American University, 26 years on active duty in the U.S. Army as a military attorney practicing national security law at the highest levels with the Department of Defense. Final 5 years, he served as a staff judge advocate general counsel to U.S. Cyber Command. When we come back, we'll talk about the United States attacking, or do we launch attacks against other countries, and what's going on, and how do you handle actions or from against nation states or third-party actors? And I have a question about just when it comes to espionage, because you're giving people the keys to the kingdom. So how do you know who to trust and who not to trust? Because I don't know. This just keeps me awake at night chasing my tail. 923 back in a flash, WWL. All right, here's your Jazz Fest code word. It is culture, C-U-L-T-U-R-E. Go to WWL.com/contest, enter culture, register to win tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest. Good luck, happy festing from Miller Lite, the official beer of Jazz Fest and WWL. Quickly back to Colonel Gary Cohen, Director of the Technology Law and Security Program. Been in the military at American University, been in the military 26 years. And well-versed as it relates to cyber defense. Let's talk about somebody texting in, Colonel, and a Chinese accused the United States of a cyber attack. Is the United States attacking other countries as we attack them? I would think we're at least probing to see what they can do and what they can't do. Thoughts on that and the specific Chinese charge?
Well, first, I would not. I wouldn't put a lot of credence into Chinese allegations. You know, part of this has to do with the meaning of the term cyber attack. It's used pretty broadly, anything from just gaining access to an adversary system to actually causing harm or damage through that access. So I can't get into specifics of what the U.S. does or doesn't do, other than to say that, starting certainly back in 2018, we moved within the DOD to a much more proactive posture. I think in terms of probing to understand what our adversaries are doing and their capacity, it's everything that's been happening for some time. That's the standard business of intelligence. But in terms of disrupting adversary actions against us, we've been much more proactive in the last 5, 6, 7 years. And there are some public reports of some of those operations that have happened. So, you also have to put this in the different mission sets of, at least within the DOD and Cyber Command. Some of this is supporting the traditional geographic combatant commands and their war plans. But part of it is the ongoing everyday defense of the nation in cyberspace. And again, that's where I say you have notions of defending forward and disrupting and countering cyber threats, and that is happening.
As I talk about probing and cyber threats coming from without, all you got to do is Google or put Chinese cranes in your search engine, and you'll see stories that come up every now and then about the number of Chinese cranes at ports that come from China that might have some kind of semiconductor chip. I don't know, Colonel, and I don't know what I'm talking about here. Bear with me here on this eighth grade level. But how concerned are you about Trojan horses and Chinese technology involved in the things that we rely on so heavily here, and things like ports and their ability to disrupt something like that where it's already there, and our ability to defend against something like that?
I'm very concerned, and this is an issue. We, supply chains, where the technology is coming from, backdoor accesses that can be built into the firmware and software of different computers and chips, et cetera, that come from China. And this is, we've been dealing this for some time, pushing back on using Huawei infrastructure in the U.S., et cetera. And this is absolutely something that we have to be dealing with at an increased level. That there there are vulnerabilities in our system that come from supply chain compromises from technology coming out of China.
And not just cranes, iPhones, other things, computers?
Well, I mean, just to kind of take it down to a mundane level, you know, I published a few articles some years back on this, but even commercial drones, you know, DJI is one of the market leaders in selling small commercial drones. And it's, I would say not uncoincidental that they had a program for a while where they were donating these drones to a lot of local law enforcement agencies, first responders, et cetera. And there were some studies showing that there were backdoors built into the controlling software, et cetera. So, you know, there's massive data collection, companies that have tethers back to China. There's lots of concerns about data flows back to China, the interrelationship between companies in China and the Communist Party and, you know, government leadership, et cetera. So across the spectrum of internet or digital technology, yes, it is a problem that we have to be very vigilant about.
Yeah, get me headed to the gym again, Colonel. That's nothing. Get me headed to the gym right there. When it comes to the distinguishing between criminal activities when it comes to hacking and bad actors, bad foreign countries hacking, like things like cryptocurrency, is it one and the same, or are the lines blurred there? Because if you affect a nation's economy, naturally you affect its right to defend itself or its ability to defend itself. Talk about that, if you will, please.
Sure. And, you know, yes, there is a distinction, but there's certainly overlaps, and the lines are blurred. Mm-hmm. And you can take the issue of ransomware, which has been a huge problem for years now, where, you know, an actor uses encryption malware technology to essentially extort a system owner to release data, release systems availability, et cetera. Well, you know, President Biden, during his tenure, declared that a national security problem. Generally, ransomware is done by criminal organizations. It is a criminal enterprise. But it's happening at such a level that it's becoming a national security problem. Not only that, but there's lots of evidence that North Korea uses ransomware operations through proxies and otherwise to generate currency to support its nuclear weapons development program. You know, it has a very difficult time generating hard currency otherwise, and it's using criminal activity to support its foreign policy and national, you know, defense goals. So there is a blurring. Ultimately, it really just has to do with who has primacy in dealing with a given penetration or problem set, whether that's the FBI as a lead, what role does DOD have to play in a given situation? And each of those, honestly, will just depend. And it goes back to that team approach that I talked about earlier, and coordinating and synchronizing across all the players that we have in the national security space.
Colonel, I used to love dystopian movies and apocalyptic movies and so forth. Not so much in the last couple of years, because so much of it seems like, you know, maybe we're not that far away from it. When we see things depicted like, you know, I forgot the movie that I saw on Netflix with Julia Roberts, where they shut down communications and then we turn on ourselves, or other movies along those lines. Are any of those things accurate at all? I don't know if you've seen any of them or not.
Well, I think
Leave the World Behind is one of them, I think, is what Tim tells me.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And, you know, if you go back to the days of Star Trek, when I'll date myself, but when I was a kid, you know, some of the things that we thought were whiz-bang technologies, you know, handheld communicators and stuff.
Dick Tracy.
We all have cell phones in our pockets every day now. So science fiction oftentimes kind of is prescient in what's coming down the road. But I think it would be difficult to have an absolutely catastrophic blow against the United States. I think you could have significant harm done if it's done, you know, with coordination against certain systems. But one of the benefits we also have is that there's a lot of, separation and distinction between a lot of the critical infrastructure that we rely on. And so, you know, some might go down, but others will not. And I think we are realizing more and more we have to have resiliency built in to these systems. A great example was in Ukraine where, you know, Russia impacted energy production. They hit power generation plants. And in some of those instances, the Ukrainians, they were able to just revert back to their old analog systems very quickly to get energy back up and running. So you have to have resiliency built into these systems to be able to absorb any blows.
Comes back to pulling a rope, getting the engine going, huh, Colonel?
Yeah, I mean, at some level. Can't forget those skills.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll come back to talk about this some more with us.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. It's just everything. Gary Korn, Director of the Technology Law and Security Program and Adjunct Professor of Cyber and National Security Law and the Law of Armed Conflict at American University. I'm getting some texts from people saying, yeah, well, the U.S. does it too. I hope the U.S. does it too. I hope the U.S. is constantly probing, and I hope that we're right on a par with any of the other nations. And you know, you got to realize it's this thing, I would think, changes by the second in terms of who's got the advantage over whom, if not minute. 9:40, we'll talk to Mike Pearlstein. We come back, WWL-TV investigator, about a teen escaping juvenile jail and terrorizing a New Orleans woman. Right now, it's time for traffic on WWL. 9:45, quarter till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Mike Pearlstein, WWL-TV investigative reporter. Decisions and actions have consequences, and man, when it comes to restoring juveniles, that's what we're talking about. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm fine.
You're the reporter. You tell me the story, my friend. I'm going to sit back and listen and ask you if I have any questions.
Well, the one thing that most people may know about if they have followed the news was an escape from the juvenile justice jail, otherwise known as the Juvenile Justice Intervention Center, back in September, in which a 17-year-old named Carlos Taylor fled out of a courtroom, unshackled, no handcuffs, through a couple of unlocked doors, hopped a fence, and is now accused of carjacking a 72-year-old woman, 73 now, in that parking lot of the LSU Dental School nearby. So it was a really, high-profile breach. There was a press conference. There was an all-points bulletin, a manhunt that expanded throughout South Louisiana before they finally captured Carlos Taylor in Baton Rouge. He is now facing all kinds of additional charges, not just the carjacking, the charge that had him in juvenile court in the first place being transferred to adult court on attempt murder, but now he's accused of being part of a, you know, criminal gang with a whole host of charges. So what was not known at the time of that escape and carjacking was that there was an almost identical escape, didn't get very far, I'm calling it an escape attempt, back in January. And that led to all kinds of finger-pointing, blame, proposed remedies to basically secure these gaps, these security lapses, and all of the acrimony didn't allow that to happen. And the most, I guess the most simple solution would have been a lock on a door that leads from the court to the jail, to a corridor that leads to the jail. And it never happened until Carlos Taylor, at that point, the director of the JJIC, Deshaun Williams, said despite the judge's misgivings about a lock, which the judges say would have posed a risk to them in case of emergency like a fire, said, nope, I cannot risk another escape. We've had two now, one that the public knew about with Carlos Taylor, but the other, which I uncovered back in January, almost identical. So it really was a story of missed opportunity And it really, the consequences were bad enough. We spoke exclusively to Barbara Lane, the 70, you know, plus year old, longtime New Orleans entertainer, who, while she was not hurt, her car was wrecked, her belongings stolen, music, sheets of music that she had for decades, all gone because of this incident. So a real cautionary tale, that fortunately we were able to get a hold of a whole string of documents, emails, and letters back and forth between the judges and the jail over these security lapses.
And there's also a question about restraints, right?
Yeah, so the restraints, and it had us digging deep into the children's code where there's a special set of laws for juveniles, obviously because of their age are handled differently than adults in the criminal justice system. But at the time of the January escape, Dashiell Williams, head of the jail, she basically put out a policy that we are bringing the juveniles to court in handcuffs and shackles from now on. We cannot risk this type of escape. And some of the judges pushed back. It was allowed for a while, but eventually a defense attorney filed a motion. It went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, pointing out in the children's code, you can't have juveniles in handcuffs and shackles in the court itself. Now, you can bring them there in the handcuffs. You can put them on as they go back to be transported to jail. But I guess for the, you know, treating children differently than adults, the handcuffs and shackles come off. And you can see that in, you know, those court hearings where there might be a parent or guardian to see a kid in handcuffs, and for the kid to be in handcuffs could be traumatizing and actually work against a rehabilitation. However, there's a little kind of sub rule embedded within that law that you can keep the handcuffs and shackles on if you make a motion to the judge on each individual defendant that this kid is a flight risk or a danger. And that was viewed by the jail and the DA's office as just too cumbersome. You know, these are kind of fluid hearings. Sometimes it takes hours, you know, to bring a kid into a court. The dockets are not timed that precisely. So to come with a motion for each individual kid that you think is a danger was viewed as just not viable. And another argument from the jail was, of all of the juveniles who are arrested, most do get returned home to parent or guardian. And it's just the ones in the most serious crimes, almost all violent crimes, are the ones who are detained. And their argument was, look, the ones who are detained, who are sitting here in our lockup, are already the ones who are a danger, flight risk, and should be in shackles. Well, the court ultimately rejected that. And that then led to the second issue, which was a really simple one. It was about a $25 fix to put a lock on a particular door that leads from court into the corridor that ultimately leads to the jail. And on that one, the jail prevailed. They put that lock on there and said, I'm not putting the public at risk. It's going to stay. The judges objected, but they ended up having a master, I guess, key that the judges and the courts now have. So hopefully that solves this once and for all. But this was the kind of things that go on in juvenile court outside of the public eye because of all of the confidentiality attached to juveniles in our court system.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate the time and the story. 9:53, we'll take a break, find out what Newell's got for us when we come back on WWL.